All right, good morning. Welcome to our third in a row session discussing sort of urban air mobility space and EV toll market. We're pleased to have Joby Aviation attend our autos conference for the first time. They've attended our industrials conference, and I hosted Eric at that back in March. So happy to carry on the conversation again. Eric, maybe good to, you know, first introduce yourself. I think you have a short video as well, but, you know, your role at the company, and maybe just provide a short overview for the business for those who be that may be less familiar with the company.
Yeah, and thanks, Bill, for having us here today. I have to say, save the best for last, right? It's great to be here, and it's great to be in this industry for 15 years now. I've been working in this space for quite a while. I came to Joby in 2021 as part of the Uber Elevate acquisition deal that I led at Uber after running that team for a while, and then came over to Joby and I'm chief product officer now. I oversee a bunch of the different aspects of going to market, building out the software and systems and services that will allow us to actually offer urban air mobility on an on-demand basis to people for whenever they want to. And that's really the vision of Joby. So Joby's been around for about 15 years. It was founded in late 2009. Really at the forefront of the development of this technology of electric motors, electric propulsion systems, all of the key technologies to allow aircraft to transition from kind of the traditional technologies to kind of embrace EVs, the same technology in EVs that is, you know, changing transportation all over the world. So we've been at the forefront of that. We've actually developed a lot of the technology ourselves because this technology just didn't exist, and still actually in a lot of places doesn't really exist to allow you to kind of integrate it in an off-the-shelf way. So we have built a vertically integrated company to attack this problem. We've built the component layer, we've built the vehicle platform layer, and we're building the services and operation layer that allows us to deliver that service into partners like Uber and Delta, some of our key go-to-market partners. And we're actually, we just got wrapped up some flight testing that we've been doing. We were over in Dubai earlier this year. We did a multi-week campaign of flight testing with pilots in the heat, up to 110 degrees flying there. I have a quick video to show some of that if we wanna play that. Give us a sense of what we do. So this really encapsulates what we do. We have been designing and building this aircraft now, and now we're getting ready for operational readiness. So we are testing this aircraft in different environments, whether it's Dubai, whether it's at our test flight facilities in California. We've got five of that aircraft flying in our fleet, doing testing every day, working toward our certification, but also working toward the learning all of the unknown unknowns that we have. And so we really believe in learning by doing, which is what we lean into every day.
Great. I got a set of questions, but if anybody has any questions in the audience, we'll stop and please let me know. I've been talking about the regulatory landscape for all of these discussions thus far. So maybe at a high level, can you frame the U.S. regulatory landscape as it relates to advanced air mobility, especially given the recent news flow around government support for drones, autonomous, and hybrid?
Yeah, absolutely. So we really have been, we've been working with the FAA since 2019, I think, is when we first started formally engaging with the FAA and the type certification program for the S4 aircraft, which is the one that that you saw flying there. So it's a process, and we've been working through that process. We actually publish on a quarterly basis the kind of scorecard that we score ourselves, and we score the FAA in some sense in terms of all of the documentation, really what the basis of that is, that we have to generate and have approved on in order to finish our type certificate. And that's the foundation of that certification work. And so we've been really impressed with the lean-in that the FAA has had overall in terms of this process, and it's actually accelerated. So the overall engagement from the government, whether it's DOT or the FAA in this administration, has been actually really good. And we've seen an acceleration of response times, of turnaround times, all of the things that really like feed into getting building momentum toward getting the certification done overall.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the formal regular process. There's also then like the executive order, the EIPP that has been put forward now, and we're still waiting for all of the details to be ironed out on that. But it's really, I think, quite promising in terms of ability to accelerate learnings, accelerate introduction of these types of aircraft into the space, and really start to, essentially plant that flag in terms of leadership on this at a global level in this industry, and continue to drive the industry in that direction.
Yeah, I have nothing else. The EO put a lot of excitement in the space and has definitely helped some of the equities involved, including yours. But I guess there's been discussion of the potentially accelerating the pace of adoption, which you kind of just alluded to. But are there opportunities to bring forward a certification timeline, given what's clearly been pushouts relative to prior expectations?
Yeah, so we are continuing to work with the FAA on basically a daily basis on this. And so we see, like I said, we are seeing acceleration in terms of the response times, turnaround times, in terms of the work that we have to do to finalize all of these plans, get the plans done, get all of our testing done and accepted. And so we actually think that there's a lot of momentum building, and the FAA is really leaning into this.
Mm-hmm. So maybe just setting more of the stage on this from an FAA certification process, where are we in the process? What is the significance, being on the path to begin TIA? You can maybe define what that is, flight testing within the next several months.
So fundamentally, the FAA, the type certification process, is the big thing that we talk about all the time. It's essentially a design certification. So in the process of being able to offer a commercial aviation product, you have to have the design certified, you have to have your production system certified, and you have to have your operations certified. All of those things have to be in place in order to launch essentially a product that the public can pay for and use on a regular basis. We actually already have our operational certification. We got that a few years ago. We're using that in the context of an employee shuttle, and we've built out what I call Elevate OS. So all of that, we can come back to it in a little bit, I think. All of that knowledge and learnings that we had at Uber Elevate, we kind of condensed into software now, and we've built out that as the foundational platform for this future service. We're actually working on our production certificate. The target there is to have that simultaneous with our type certificate, which is kind of an industry standard thing to do. And then really the bulk of the effort, though, is on this design certification, the type certificate. And so we've broken this down into five stages. The way that the FAA has technical orders that govern this process, but it's kind of like a couple of small stages, one giant one, and then you're done. So that's less helpful. So we actually have just kind of discretized it a little bit differently, and that's how we report out on this. And we are in what we've deemed stage four of a five-stage process. So stage four is where you take all of your certification plans, which is stage three, that that you've agreed to with the FAA across every different aspect of the entire airplane. And then you write detailed test plans for every single test that you're going to do. And all of those test plans have to be reviewed and accepted by the FAA. So we are in the process of doing that. We've submitted 70% of the entire set of test plans that we anticipate having to write to the FAA, and they've accepted 53% of them, which is really great progress if you look at our overall progress over the last few quarters. So that's kind of accelerating. We're super excited by that. And of course, this represents many, 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 many things that are actually happening all simultaneously. So as these test plans are getting written and submitted and accepted, we're doing all of the testing work. And we're testing components, we're testing assemblies and subsystems and systems, all of this. And then we submit that final data to the FAA when the results of those tests, some of them the FAAs are witnessing, some of them they've delegated witnessing to our internal employees. And then that's stage five, and the FAA formally accepts all of that data as passing the test and mapping to the certification basis.
Question?
So the FAA, that stage one is what's called the certification basis. That's where it's the high-level safety intent, and that's actually the first thing we negotiate with the FAA. For a normal airplane, right, that's actually literally published in federal law. It's like Part 23, Part 25, Part 27. Those are the kind of the standard safety standards, essentially. For this novel aircraft, we actually ended up negotiating that, essentially. So some of it was taken from Part 23, some of it from Part 27, some of it from other places. Some of it had to be special and kind of negotiated and written with the FAA. So that was all done kind of up front in that, and then that cascades down. So those test plans all have to trace back up to the safety standards in that certification basis that we negotiated with the FAA early on in the process.
Great. Thanks for that. So I guess when we think about coming back to the TIA, so what are the key milestones the team's looking to achieve before the testing can begin? The team has spoken about using a fleet of five test aircraft for the TIA testing next year. Would Joby, you know, think about building additional to speed the process, or is that really not feasible?
Yeah, so kind of going in order on that. So this we've talked a lot about in the last few quarters about this thing called TIA. So TIA is Type Inspection Authorization. This is a really big milestone when it comes to working with the FAA. This means that the FAA has authorized their test pilots to get into our aircraft and start executing flight test plans. Flight test plans are one of these test plans. There's many different flight test plans, but flight test plans are part of what we call stage four, these test plans that we're submitting to the FAA that they're then reviewing and accepting formally. So when there's other tests that have to be done in order for the FAA, many other tests that have to be done in order for the FAA to allow their pilots to get into our aircraft and start to fly the aircraft against these flight test plans that we've agreed on. So this is a really big deal. And kind of to the best of our knowledge, every company that's entered that phase of TIA flight testing where the FAA pilots are actually flying the aircraft eventually comes out of it. So it's kind of it's like the last lap in some ways, the way we see it, where we're getting all of the pieces have come into place to allow that big step of the FAA pilots to be getting in the aircraft and formally executing those test plans. And we're targeting early next year to be able to start doing that.
Okay, great. Given the focus of this conference, obviously an autos conference, I want to discuss a bit on the partnership you have with Toyota. Maybe you can kind of briefly just outline what this partnership's all about. What's the significance of automakers getting involved with the space? And maybe how Toyota can potentially help Joby scale its manufacturing footprint, maybe first in California, later in Ohio.
Yeah, so Toyota was an early investor. They came in our Series B, I believe it was, a while back, before I was at Joby, actually, as through one of their venture, the what's now Toyota Ventures, and Toyota AI Ventures, I think it was at the time. And then they led our Series C in 2019, 2020, which was a pretty big round that we raised, kind of the last big private round that we raised before we did the public listing in 2021. And they remain our largest outside investor and actually announced a kind of a further investment about a little less than a year ago of an additional $500 million that they're putting in two tranches. And so we've received that first tranche earlier this year, and we're working toward a kind of a milestone that will trigger the second tranche of $250 million subsequently. And so really taking a step back, though, the Toyota has had an interest in flying mobility for a long time. And so there's the Toyota family has been very, very interested in this space, and they've made several different efforts along the way in the flying mobility space. And so really this is kind of just on path in some sense for the vision that they have of doing more than just ground mobility, but rather kind of a more all-encompassing type of mobility. And it's really exciting to be able to work hand in hand with a group that has that long-term vision that that is seeing kind of where things are going and working with us. So that's kind of the strategic piece of it and why they're so invested and leaned in with us. On a tactical front, they're working with us from a manufacturing standpoint on a daily basis. And so we have Toyota team members in our factories working with our leaders and our floor workers to look at things like optimizing process. You know, they're the best in the world at Kaizen, right? It's how do you make everything better and take carve time out even at this stage when we're still building early copies of everything that we're building. And because we're building a lot of things, like there's a lot of opportunities to do that. But that's the type of work that they do with us, where they're really kind of they're both directly kind of analyzing and helping and giving advice, but they're also coaching our leaders on how to think about this, how to think in the Toyota Production System way, which is really the gold standard around the world as to how do you do this type of complex manufacturing that that has to all come together and then continuously drive quality up and cost down.
Mm-hmm. So you spoke to that. So one of the milestones unlocked, the second tranche of the investment is including a strategic manufacturing alliance. I guess, maybe taking one step further, like what is the vision for a manufacturing alliance on top of the existing Kaizen and other work you've been doing thus far?
Yeah, so the strategic alliance that we're working toward is really about taking the next step. So we are, we recently announced that we had increased our footprint in California, in Marina, to be able to capacitize up to 24 aircraft a year. And that's a big step for us. That's we're making this steady progress toward increasing our capabilities and our capacity. But taking a step past that, taking a step to the type of scale that we believe is going to be necessary to feed this market as we're able to launch and start to provide services both in places here like New York City and other places around the world like Dubai and Japan, the places that we're working with partners to be able to launch this. And we know we're going to need more capacity. And so working with Toyota on what kind of how can we work together in this kind of concept of a strategic alliance to take that next step and start to build at a higher scale, at higher rates. That's what that's all about. And it's really exciting work that we're doing, and excited to be able to share more about it soon.
Mm-hmm. So Joby recently announced plans to acquire Blade's passenger business for $125 million to help bolster its go-to-market strategy on the commercial side. So, Blade's company we're familiar with, I think our term was exactly net positive for both companies. So something we thought was pretty interesting. Yeah. Can you help understand, why now, why Blade, and how this, having access to this know-how infrastructure can help position Joby relative to peers in terms of entry to service or any other positive factors you may want to speak to?
Yeah, absolutely. So super excited about this this announcement that we made last week that we're bringing in the Blade passenger business along with Rob Wiesenthal, who will remain kind of the CEO of that segment when it comes over to Joby when the deal closes. And so that's really but what Blade's done is they've built a great brand. They've built a great customer experience, and they've showed how to make this type of service work using existing machinery, existing equipment that's available right now. Because it's more than just about the technology. It's about the technology put into service and actually understanding all of those key learnings about how do you actually do customer service? How do you actually operate this type of a business? What are the gotchas? And that's what's incredibly exciting to be able to essentially just jumpstart that aspect of our business, have a running start at it when we're ready to launch. And it really fits into this overall arc of commercial readiness that we're working toward, that we're getting all of these pieces put into place so that as this we get to the finish line in certification and are ramping up our production kind of in parallel with that, we're going to be able to hit the ground running and start offering the services quickly and as kind of effectively as possible.
Mm-hmm. Maybe something near and dear to you. I mean, how would this blade existing bookings and operational platforms and some of the back end and front end that they've developed, how's that expected, or how would you think that would be integrated with Elevate OS, which is, you know, Jovi's homegrown platform, or maybe even your prior jobs, you know,
yeah, platform. Yeah. Certainly all kind of a continuum in some sense. So really what Blade's focused on, as essentially the front end to, this type of service, like the customer interaction piece of it, they've built out this layer of software that, that solves a lot of contingencies, contingency management, all of these types of things that the kind of the real world operation has to solve. We've really focused on the back end about kind of the operator side of this. Like, what are the things that really make the Part 135, that operating certificate, operate incredibly efficiently? And we've done some work on that customer facing side, but we're much earlier on that piece than we are than Blade is, obviously having a real life product in the market for multiple years now. So I think it's really complementary in a lot of ways that we can bring these pieces together. We've got tech teams already engaging, and super super excited about that, and more to come there. But I think that it's going to be a really nice pieces of the puzzle fitting together to accelerate our rollout.
Yeah. Just want to pause again and see if there's any questions before moving on. All right. So after Blade, I just want to kind of maybe spend a little bit more time on your activities in Dubai. You talked about expecting to fly passengers next year. First of all, like, how should we think about that timing? I think it's more like end of next year, but can you give us a sense of what, you know, this operation could look like, and maybe subsequently what this can maybe make the U.S. operations look like soon after?
Yeah, so we announced last year that we we'll be the air taxi provider for Dubai when we launch, and so we're partnering with the Road Transport Authority there, which is the transportation regulator in the Emirate of Dubai, and. Just and Dubai is, you know, just for those that aren't familiar, I guess Dubai is part of the UAE, so the United Arab Emirates, which is kind of a confederation in some sense of these Emirates, a little bit different than a state in the U.S., but not quite a country. So it's an interestingly different kind of polity in terms of how it works. A very strong regulator though, the RTA, that has kind of authority over this space in the whole Emirate of Dubai. Dubai has become this incredible tourist destination, and they actually are investing a lot of money to drive that even harder, right? And so the numbers, I don't remember the numbers, but in terms of the percent increases that of folks that are coming into Dubai since like 2019 is quite amazing, actually. And so we see that there is both an incredible opportunity just from the standpoint of, you know, if you went to Dubai 5-6 years ago, the traffic wasn't that bad. If you go to Dubai now, traffic's terrible. So it's, you could see and feel it when you're there, the growth, the excitement, the opportunity in some sense for this type of mobility in that space. If you combine that with a government that wants to lean into new technology, that wants to be at the leading edge of this type of mobility across the board, honestly, not just with air taxis, but with a number of different technologies kind of running the gamut, that's really exciting. And so what we did is kind of crafted this relationship with them where we'll provide air taxis, and we're working with the national level regulators. This is a GCAA, kind of the FAA equivalent in the UAE, which has a purview over the Dubai portion as well, to take the work that we're doing the FAA and accelerate the final stage, essentially, with extra resources that they're devoting to review review test results, review the documentation, and get us to kind of think of it as like an early authorization to start flying with passengers there. And they're really excited, really leaning in hard on that. And that's kind of the opportunity space.
I guess where's the team in that process, the GCAA certification process? How many, like, what more flight campaigns or flight testing? What other verification needs to be done before passenger flights take place?
Yeah, so we have a number of essentially a project plan laid out with them, and so we're working through these stages in terms of doing both all of the documentation and paperwork and the different meetings and interactions like that, as well as then these flight testing campaigns. So more of that coming up, but everything is kind of proceeding at pace, I would say, in terms of the plans that we've laid out.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about the ability or the capacity to support 24 aircraft annually. How many incremental aircraft do you expect to be built and delivered for early Dubai operations next year?
We're not revealing numbers at this point in terms of that the number of aircraft that we'll be deploying there, but you can imagine that it's at least one. but we are going to provide enough aircraft to kind of provide a meaningful, you know, a useful service, and so that's. That's part of our discussions, and it'll kind of depend on some of these timelines and how everything comes together. But that's part of our capacity planning overall. Mm-hmm. And actually coming back to your question, a couple questions back that I didn't answer actually. The number of aircraft toward the TIA flight testing that we're doing.
Yeah.
So we certainly are always evaluating what the possibilities are to accelerate builds. If we can add another aircraft into that flight testing campaign, and it's going to meaningfully accelerate what we're able to do, that's something we take really seriously. So this is kind of a constant evaluation that we're doing because of the vertical integration, actually, we have in some sense more control over to be able to do this and to react to realization like, oh, if we could add this, or reorder these things and add this other capability in, we could actually overall speed up the schedule. Mm-hmm. And we have teams that are constantly looking at that and trying to figure out how do we carve days, weeks, months out of our timelines to be able to move things along even faster.
That last point reminded me of something. Clearly Joby is the most vertically integrated amongst especially the companies we've hosted here thus far, which I think maybe do you spend more time on the batteries and modules and packs, but less so on the airframes and things like that, maybe a little bit more on propellers as well. But you're clearly the most vertically integrated of these. Why is that an advantage other than speed to market? What other advantages would you think would be the case with your strategy?
Yeah, so I see it as we're building kind of a full stack aviation company. And maybe to use too much of a software analogy, but we have kind of this bottom layer of the stack, which is these component level technologies that we are developing both the capabilities on, how do you rapidly design a composite structure, but then how do you certify it too? And so building up both the design, build, test, and certify capabilities for all of the constituent pieces. And then we're building up the platform layer, so the vehicle platform itself, where we're taking all of those technologies, putting them together into this first product that we're certifying to bring to market, and then we're building the service kind of tech stack layer on top of that. So that's the overall approach that we're taking to this problem. Any of those layers, you can both add another technology in and then essentially combine them in different ways, right, for different kind of variations of the product in the future. And I think that the announcement that we made in terms of the work that we're doing with L3Harris is a good example of this. So, fundamentally, because we control these pieces and we control the manufacturing and kind of the variations of things like even the composite structure, we can take one of the aircraft that we're building and adapt it pretty rapidly to add different capabilities, initially as prototypes, but then as like potentially kind of derivative product lines down the road. And that the vertical integration lets us do that, I think, a lot more easily than can be done in other contexts.
Mm-hmm. So let's spend more time on that. This was exciting opportunity, frankly, but like this partnership with L3Harris to commercialize platforms for applications, I guess, can you speak more broadly on Joby's efforts to develop different variants of the aircrafts? How does this fit in with the overall strategy? And maybe even on that, what are you going to be doing? What are they going to be doing? At least maybe starting off with.
Yeah, so the announcement was that we're essentially exploring how do we take variants of the S4 platform and then work with L3 to integrate essentially their different products and payloads onto that as an offering essentially to DoD. And we've been working with the DoD for quite a while. I think we were the first company really working in this space. pretty closely with initially DIUX and the DIU and AFWERX and Agility Prime through these different programs of innovation that the Air Force and DoD have put forward. And we, you know, one of the things we learned, one of the points of these programs was for the DoD to learn about this technology, learn about what capabilities are, what the opportunities are in the space, and where they want to then further invest, forward invest into the future. And so that's, the reason we built the hydrogen version, or the hydrogen variant, I guess, of the aircraft last year that we flew and did a 560-some-mile flight with it, just to kind of show the capabilities of that, was under in partnership, essentially, with Agility Prime for doing that. And that was basically a hybridized version, just a kind of, it was like a hybrid on hard mode, I call it, because we used cryogenically fueled liquid hydrogen fuel cell variant that we'd actually put together in about 6 weeks, actually. So we'd been doing powertrain work, but that was the aircraft that we flew here in New York City in the end of 23. We flew it here, we brought it back to California. It took about 6 weeks to take some stuff out on the inside, put a big hydrogen tank in it, and then went back up and flew it in this hybrid configuration and for a really long flight. So that, I think, helped to kind of shape some of the thinking, though, about what the capabilities are on kind of hybridized versions of these aircraft. So that's the kind of the foundation of the thinking of this work with L3, that we think that a hybridized version. So think of it as like a heavy fuel kind of turbo hybrid, as opposed to the kind of the more advanced but further out in, I think, technology readiness of the liquid hydrogen fueled version of our aircraft. Is something that's pretty interesting, has capabilities that are pretty interesting to DoD, and has opportunities to integrate the kind of the things that the L3 builds and is really good at, and then leverage their connectivity to the customers to explore what the opportunities are there.
How should we think about the long-term opportunity for hybrid, or if you want to say hydrogen too, that's probably even more long-term, but for, you're doing the hybrid work, which is particularly useful for defense, but frankly, it's probably pretty useful for commercial as well. So how should we think about the long-term opportunities as well as the fungibility between these programs?
Yeah, I think that that's another advantage of our vertical integration, that we see an opportunity to take, to initially demonstrate. I mean, we plan to fly a demonstrator of this shortly, I would say. I think we said in the fall to kind of show what this type of heavy fuel hybrid can do and what it looks like. And so we see an incredible opportunity there. And so the initial application is kind of more in a kind of a UAS non-certified context, say, which I think is an opportunity to flex on, again, some of our component manufacturing and ability to kind of assemble something that can be applicable in a different space. I think long-term, though, we always see this as kind of a dual use in a lot of ways, where we're going to learn a whole bunch of things if we launch, find the right opportunity and launch a product line along those lines, with a partner like L3Harris. But the learnings from that can then come back into the civil side, and certainly that's part of our thinking about this, because we control both the kind of the component layer of the tech stack as well as the vehicle platform layer. We can plan and think about how these things interact back and forth to accelerate our future product development.
Yeah. Any questions before we're getting close to the end here? Just want to make sure if there's any questions, we can get them addressed. Maybe real quickly, where does autonomous fit in the overall strategy?
So we think autonomy is incredibly important in the near term in certain contexts, and the long term in other contexts. So we bought a company called X-Wing last year that's been working on autonomy for kind of conventional aircraft. And so one of the applications, though, of this technology that they've developed, we call Superpilot, is in a Cessna Caravan. And that's that a lot of the work there was with DoD. So there's a lot of interest in, essentially being able to take autonomy, retrofit it into existing platforms like that, and then leverage them in other contexts, shall we say. And so there's a lot of ongoing work on some of the contracts that have come out of that context. But that same core technology, that Superpilot technology, can be applied to kind of our S4. And so that, if you think about the uh, this turbo hybrid UAS version of it that we've talked about now or have kind of considered in this partnership with L3. Think of like that superpilot technology, the kind of adding the turbo hybrid and bringing that together, and that's that potential platform for the DoD applications.
Great. As we wrap up, any sort of closing remarks, anything, you know, maybe we didn't discuss or things that are misunderstood or just sort of final thoughts for the audience?
I think that one of the really key things that I always like to emphasize is that the opportunity here is we believe is really quite large, and it's really unlocked by a couple of different things. One of them is the overall kind of technology of electric vertical takeoff and landing that allows the overall operating cost to come down. And we think that's really important, particularly in the longer arc of all this. But I think an even more important piece of the technology is the noise, the acoustics. And I think that many people in New York understand this pretty clearly, that the opportunity to take this new technology and use it to build vehicles that are kind of dramatically different in sound profile is what really unlocks the addressable market, we believe. That essentially may have kind of a structural cap in some sense with traditional technology, that technology of altering that acoustic profile, of making these things so quiet that you can't hear them at all when they're flying over, that really unlocks things. And that's why we made that a priority from the very beginning of the technology we've been developing. Our motors, our batteries, the powertrain, the whole aircraft is optimized around acoustics, and being able to drive that acoustic signature as low as we can. And we think that's going to be really, really important as this market launches and then starts to grow.
Well, great. You know, really appreciate you sharing your insights again and all the progress you guys have made. And we'll look forward to seeing further progress in the future. But thanks for supporting the conference and good luck with your meetings today.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thanks.